While in many ways a brand new ship, the Enterprise was effectively Odyssey-class, though modified somewhat to lose the old island command and control of the original design that mimicked Blue Navy carriers to some degree. She was obsolete as far as starships went. Even though she only had a few years on her hull, literally the definition of too valuable to scrap, not useful enough to sail. "Sir, we can't fight the Enterprise the way we currently have our squadron configured. She'll be cut to shreds by Imperial lasers." Eric nodded. "I know. I'm going to work up new doctrine for her. But we're also getting her a full complement of Vorpals and every drone they can fit on her. I'll find a way to fight her." Eric knew that Roberts was too disciplined to tell a CO, "better you than me," but his expression didn't leave much to interpretation. "Yes, sir." "I'll worry about that. So what you need to do is take the squadron out to the edge of Premenae-controlled territory. We have a decent idea where Imperial space begins, so focus your patrol along the likely approaches they should take." "Yes." "Orders if the enemy does make a move?" Eric hesitated. "Harass and fall back. Do not risk your command unnecessarily. Get as much intelligence as possible. If you can bleed them out, then go ahead. But we'd rather have you and the squadron intact than otherwise. I don't expect that they'll risk another exploratory probe. We've bloodied their noses twice now. Unless they're complete idiots, they're either going to back off or bring their A-game." Roberts agreed. Frankly, he'd have gone for overwhelming force a lot earlier. But then he did have the advantage of knowing the state of Earth and Primenae defenses. "I'm assuming that you don't believe they'll back off," Roberts asked, though he honestly already knew the answer. "The Imperials aren't the sort to back off," Eric said. "For whatever reason, they opened their campaign with genocide, Captain. You don't do that if you have any intentions of backing off." There was truth there. "Agreed," Roberts sighed. "Do you want me to leave you a couple of the rogues?" "No, take the full squadron. You'll be down one heroic as it is. Not going to ask you to run any lighter than you must." "Thank you, sir. I'll get the squadron winding up," Robert said, then hesitated as he checked around to see if anyone was in sight. They were alone. "Sir, off the record, what's going on?" Eric sighed. He'd gone through the grinder with Roberts more than once. The man was solid as a rock, even if some of his subordinates were known to joke that he had the personality of one, too. Eric didn't like keeping things from the man, but how did you explain something like Odysseus? "Captain, if I told..." "You wouldn't believe me. That's not just me blowing smoke. I swear. The situation is possibly the strangest thing I've ever seen in my life, and you know how strange my life has been." Roberts chuckled. "Coming from anyone else, I might laugh in their face. It's that classified?" "It will be, assuming we ever figure out how to explain it to command. For now, it's just that weird." "You know you need to step on those damn rumors, sir. If the enlisted get it in their heads that the Odysseus is a ghost ship, you'll never be able to run up an effective crew again."
"Easier said than done, especially when there's a little truth to the rumors," Eric admitted.
"Sir?"
"I'll explain it to you sometime," Eric said. "Preferably when you have time to come aboard for a visit and see the issue yourself. For now, just look after my squadron, all right?"
"Yes, sir."
"Good. Let's get something to eat before you ship out," Eric said, shifting his tone to a more jocular one. "I think I can scrounge something up, Commodore."
P.S. Desay. Admiral Grayson stepped through the air seal and into the open compartment beyond, where a man was waiting for her. She smiled as she recognized Rael Tanner. The Primenae's High Admiral was a man of slight stature, but carried with him an intangible aura that marked him as being in charge more than his pristine white uniform ever could.
"Admiral!" he greeted her, smiling widely. "Welcome aboard the Desay."
Grayson was glad to see Rael again.
"It's a pleasure to be here, Admiral. She's a lovely ship. I believe we scanned some differences as you approached."
"Indeed you did, Admiral," Tanner said cheerfully. "We have begun adapting more of your concepts to our vessels, as well as utilizing some old and new concepts of our own. The Desay is our new, what was it called, flagship?"
"That's right," Grayson said. "And please, call me Amanda."
Only if you call me Rail, Amanda, he countered.
Of course, Rail.
Excellent. Now, our meal will be prepared shortly, but...
He became more serious. I believe we have more weighty discussions to manage first.
I believe we do.
I have prepared a secure room,
Tanner said, gesturing to the lift. Before we retire there, Grayson asked, might I impose on you for the use of your long-range transmission systems?
Of course.
The Admiral snapped a finger, and a reader was dropped into her hand by an aide, which she handed over to Tanner.
The coordinates and message are within.
They will be sent immediately.
Tanner accepted the reader, only to hand it off quickly to one of his own aides with a nod.
Now then?
Grayson nodded and gestured casually to her aides, telling them to wait for her before she and the Admiral entered the lift. It was a short trip to the conference room the Admiral had sealed off, neither of them speaking until the door was sealed and they were alone.
Your Captain Weston has a habit of destroying expectations,
Tanner said dryly as he walked over to one of the chairs and slumped into the auto-forming furniture, letting the seat twist and wrap itself around him. Grayson sat down much more carefully, a little twitchy as the chair beneath her shifted and twisted to provide proper support.
I wish I could protest him belonging to me, but it seems that for my sins, I have been afflicted with the Commodore.
Ah, yes, Commodore, apologies, Tanner said. We do not have a similar rank.
We've occasionally lost it ourselves over the years,
Grayson smiled weakly. Currently, Eric is one of the very few Commodores in the Earth's Black Navy. Some nations refer to the rank as a rear or vice-admiral position.
Ah, yes. I suppose that might be closer to our use, Tanner said. Has he shown you Odysseus?
You mean the young boy in ancient battle armor and...
Grayson's expression twisted slightly. Glitter pink eyeshadow?
Indeed, Tanner said, apparently missing Grayson's expression. I find myself uncertain what to think of it all. In fact, I must confess, I did not entirely believe the Commodore, not until I returned to my office on Ranquil.
Grayson stiffened.
Central?
Precisely,
Tanner said, his expression darkening markedly as he remembered.
The moment I sealed my door, he appeared. Central was most fascinated by the existence of Odysseus. He seemed to wish that I asked the commander to bring his ship close to Ranquil.
That's not likely to happen.
I expected much the same, Tanner admitted with a wry smile. The conversation with Central, however, was very interesting.
I wonder why he bothered. If he could just read your mind, why show himself?
Ah, Tanner relaxed slightly. I believe you have not quite grasped the nature of the mental link, if you will. As I understand it, these beings do not read minds so much as experience thoughts. They cannot, for example, delve into your memories unless you are actively experiencing those memories.
So he showed up to prod your brain so you'd think about what he wanted to know.
Tanner spread his arms, fingers splayed out widely, in an expression Grayson recognized as being close to a shrug for the Primine.
In effect, Tanner admitted, though one might also describe it as being close to a conversation about something that interests us, I sense no animosity there, more an almost apathy at worst.
I'm not certain that's any better, Grayson responded.
Perhaps not, but who am I to judge the minds of immortals? I'll judge them, Grayson growled. It's my job. If they're a threat to my people, that puts them in my sights. I will not argue with that, except perhaps to say that I do not believe that they can be a threat to our people. If the commander is correct about them, then they really are nothing, or at least would be far lessened without us.
Maybe, but that doesn't mean they need specific groups or individuals.
Grayson countered.
That is true, Tanner conceded. What will you do?
That was a question Grayson had been asking herself over and over since she'd left the Odysseus, but it was also a question she had no real answer for.
I suppose I'll do my job, she said finally. What that is remains to be seen.
As will I, as will we all, Tanner said. This is perhaps the most momentous discovery in the history of my people, and I find that I cannot but wish that it had come at a better time.
The understatement of the century, Grayson thought. They were facing an existential threat. The Empire was clearly a power that could potentially annihilate every living thing in both Primenae and human star systems. Whether they had the power to do so was still somewhat debatable, but after the Drossen incident, there was no question that they had the desire and the will. The last thing either group needed right now was the added confusion that this news could cause. Damn near godlike beings right in our midst, the trouble this could stir up with fundamentalist groups alone could be enough to derail every step we've taken to prepare our defenses.
It's going to be interesting times, she said finally.
Tanner smiled. I believe that you are correct.
Grayson looked at him, feeling a hint of something almost like pity entering her expression.
Admiral, let me tell you about an ancient curse from Earth's history, she said softly.
AEV Odysseus. Steph shivered slightly as he bent over a console, working on coding tactical responses to common situations the ship might face in combat.
Hey, Dis, he said, not looking up.
How do you do that? The young voice had a petulant tone. No one else can sense me, not even the captain.
Commodore, Dis,
Steph corrected him, continuing his work as the boy in armor walked around into his line of sight.
And I'd be surprised if he couldn't, you know. Raze's positional awareness is damn near legendary.
He's the captain, Odysseus said firmly. One ship, one captain. There's no Commodore in that statement.
The boy seemed to think more about what Steph had said before going on.
And maybe you're right. He seems surprised when I appear. Sometimes, but not always,
the boy said, sounding a little more petulant.
He has a lot more on his mind than physical fight or flight, Steph explained. And yes, I suppose he is the captain, but his rank is Commodore. You have to learn when's the right time to use each.
I do?
You're the ship. Which makes you crew, too, so yes, you do.
Odysseus frowned, almost pouting.
So when do I call him Commodore?
Well, whenever there are outsiders present, for sure. Anyone who isn't one of us doesn't get to think of him as the captain. He's Commodore to them. Captain is for crew only. Also, you should call him by his rank in any official recorded sessions, though I don't expect you'll need to worry about that for a while.
So when can I call him captain, then?
If he gives you an order in a fight, Steph said, it's perfectly fine to say yes, Captain, or aye, Captain. Some prefer to call him Skipper, then, which also works in the moment. Commodore is fine, too, though mostly that'll be for new crew members who don't know him well.
Protocol is weird, Odysseus muttered, annoyed. The books don't say anything about that.
Some do. You're just reading the official stuff too closely.
Steph finished coding the new routine and straightened up to stretch a little.
Just remember that there's book protocol and actual protocol. The book is strict, and you'll never be judged wrong if you fall back to the book. But actual protocol lets people feel more like part of a team. And that's important, too.
The boy nodded seriously, then shifted his focus to the work Steph had just completed.
You could tighten that code by almost 10%. The boy suggested. Just adjust these numbers here by...
Steph held up a hand, cutting him off.
I know, though I think I could only get about 8%, so your numbers are better than mine, but you're missing the adaptive section, Dis. If I lock the ship into a purely efficient course in the scenario this is based on, then I'll lose the ability to adapt to likely surprises the enemy might drop on us.
The boy squinted slightly.
Likely surprises? Those exist?
Everything exists, Steph said, laughing. Or it seems to, the way my life is going these days. A likely surprise is something that we can reasonably predict the enemy might try, but not be certain of. The Empire, for example, likes to use their own ships as potential suicide weapons. They don't do it as their first reaction. But if we push them too hard at any point, they might just decide to kamikaze us.
Oh. I see.
A pilot doesn't just think about perfect maneuvers, Dis, Steph explained patiently, opening up another file to continue his work. We have to consider everything that can go wrong with what we're trying and plan options for as many of those scenarios as possible. Actually, flying the ship is only a small part of the job. Predicting the future is the hardest part.
There are too many variables to predict the future, Odysseus said grumpily. The math is incomplete.
Steph smiled, not quite laughing at the boy. Being introduced to Odysseus had been an interesting experience for him, given that he'd been on the bridge when the boy made his grand entrance. Steph was too busy to react the way he might normally have. He'd also been unarmed, which would have made his normal response rather difficult as well, so he'd allowed the Marines to handle security while he kept most of his attention on flying the ship. That had also afforded him the chance to observe and listen. He'd been more surprised at how unsurprised Reyes had seemed by it all. Though the boss had been without any doubt horrified, he hadn't seemed surprised. There was a story in that, one that Steph wanted to hear more about. So far, unfortunately, they'd been too busy with repairs and everything else for him to corner the Commodore someplace where he could be informal enough to wrestle the truth out of him. The boy who called himself Odysseus, though, was something very different. Others shied away from the boy, but Steph didn't see what the problem was. Sure, the mind-reading trick was a little creepy, but he'd flown with way creepier dudes in the past and considered them closer than family. Creepy was a human condition, and not a bad one in his mind. One thing he'd learned that drove the boy crazy, though, was when the math was incomplete. Working with holes in his equations truly seemed to frustrate Odysseus, which was really a bad thing to be frustrated by in Steph's opinion. The universe was nothing but incomplete equations. You don't need every variable to predict the future, Steph said aloud. You just need the big ones. Getting close is good enough, and the closer you can get, the better your reaction time will be when the moment comes and you have to deal with the variables you couldn't identify. Don't let your obsession with perfection become the enemy of being good enough. Odysseus hummed slightly, not looking happy with the suggestions before fading away. Steph just shook his head and went back to work. Odysseus was confused by his confusion. Since awakening, he hadn't been able to answer any of the haunting questions that swirled in his mind. He didn't know what he was, and no one else did either. He thought hundreds of thoughts at the same time, many of them about his own existence, but none of them answered any of his questions. Much of what he knew came from the computers that had been installed in him. He thought he was the ship, but he had no proof of that. Proof seemed to matter to most of the people, he had realized very early on, and Odysseus had dedicated his time to finding proof of everything, to completing the equation. Now, though, one of the people he liked? Did he like anything? Odysseus put that aside for a future examination. One of the people whom he paid more attention to was telling him that proof wasn't everything, and that confused and bothered him intensely. Why was close enough an acceptable response to anything? None of it made any sense to him. It felt like the rules weren't staying the same, and that was just wrong. The rules were supposed to be locked in, references that anyone could look to in order to see where they stood. From protocol to basic laws of the universe, rules were supposed to be standards he could trust and use to determine his place in the universe. Close enough? It didn't seem right to settle for close enough.
Chapter 5 AEV Autolycus, Deep Space. Morgan Passer, captain of the auto, drifted idly in the microgravity environment of the ship's officer's lounge. He watched a movie playing on the large screen across from him, his uniform jacket floating beside him as he rubbed at his shoulder through a sweat-soaked T-shirt.
Captain, reactor will be back up in 5,
Dayu Lee announced as she swung into the room.
Duan's got the maintenance complete. Just sealing up now.
Good. Morgan reached up and grabbed a handle in the bulkhead above him. It's getting hot in here. The Autolycus was a rogue-class starship, one of the first off the line after the invasion. Unlike Heroics, the smaller rogues didn't pack the power of a singularity core.
The older fusion reactors had to be maintained regularly, and that meant all non-essential power systems needed to be shut down during the process. Light-duty items like display screens could run off batteries with no issue, but heat exchangers were a major system that needed the reactor to run. Contrary to most expectations, cold wasn't the biggest risk a starship faced in the vacuum of space. Vacuum was an excellent insulator, and starships were designed to protect against temperature extremes. Without heat exchanges to actively regulate the interior climate, a ship without power built up heat in a hurry. Eventually, the vessel would have radiated it all away, of course, and the auto would go cold. That event would have been years away, however, and the crew would have all baked to death long before it came to pass. Morgan flipped his jacket back on and casually buttoned it up, glancing over in Lee's direction. "Are we ready to move when power comes back?"
"Yes, Captain," she answered instantly. "All ship systems are prepared. Everything registers green."
"Excellent, Commander," he said, satisfied as he kicked himself off the bulkhead toward the door.
Lee shifted aside as he floated past out into the corridor beyond, then followed in his wake. The two pulled themselves into the command deck a few seconds later, just as power returned and the hum of life came back to the ship around them. Morgan sighed in pleasure as the first hints of a cooling breeze touched his face, still warm, but infinitely better than the still air they'd been enduring. He was far from the only one so affected. The main computer array booted after finally taking over from the secondary systems that had been maintaining the ship, and all the big displays came slowly back to life around them as the pair buckled into the stations. The vessel was sitting in a star system, the only living thing that existed in the hellish place, orbiting around a red giant primary at a safe distance. The King of Thieves had been brought out this far as part of Operation Prometheus, and the ongoing mission to scout and investigate stellar anomalies for anything of value or danger to Earth and her allies. This particular mission had been a bust. The anomalous stellar scans they got from the closest star had been caused by what appeared to be a collision between the celestial body and a stable black hole. The result had torn the star system to shreds, turning anything of interest into little more than rubble waiting to be swallowed by the monster that now sat at the center of the mess.
"All right, power up the main drives," Morgan ordered. "Lee, you can tell the geeks to grab whatever scans they can on our way out. We've been here long enough."
"Aye, aye, Skipper," the young lieutenant at navigation answered as the commander tapped a few commands into her console. "Done, Captain. I expect they'll be scanning right up until we transition out."
Morgan chuckled. "I don't doubt it. Let them have their fun, I suppose. This whole run has been a bust anyway. 10 stars, nothing but natural phenomena."
"We cannot, what is the phrase, win the lotto every time?" Lee asked.
"Close enough," Morgan said. "And no, you can't. And while I can't help but wish for new things to help Earth, I'll settle for not finding any more threats." He laughed. "At least we've not given the chief any more reason to play with antimatter." Lee shivered, and he didn't blame her. He still did as well whenever the thought of the dreaded event came on him unexpectedly. No man should intentionally expose his own damn ship to antimatter, and he still experienced the occasional night terror over his vessel being in such dire straits.
"No doubt the chief is saddened by that," Lee said, a smile playing at her lips as she collected herself. "He seems to enjoy his reputation."
"Only man in the fleet to be banned from setting foot on the Odysseus. By Eric Weston himself, no less," Morgan said as the auto rumbled to life around them, her drives heating up.
"Would that we could do the same," Lee responded almost wistfully, earning another laugh from Morgan.
He knew that their conversation had been overheard, of course, since they hadn't been trying to mask it in the least. Ribbing the chief was tradition now on the auto, and probably would continue with whoever took over the job when Doohan retired. Some traditions inevitably survived the men who founded them.
"Drives are lit, Captain," the helm officer announced. "All systems are go."
"All right." Morgan leaned into the straps holding him to the seat.
"Let's be moving, then. Give me a course to our next star of interest."
"Aye, Skipper. Course is already plotted, loaded, and locked."
"Well, kick the tires, Lieutenant."
"Roger, Skipper. Lighting the fires."
The lieutenant responded just before the auto rumbled deeply, and they were all forced down into their seats as the ship began to smoothly accelerate upwell of the local star. When the interior acceleration reached one gravity, the pressure evened off. Countermass systems powered up to keep it there as Morgan and the others unsnapped their restraint straps and stood up at the stations to stretch out their limbs. Gravity was a luxury on a Rogue, only present when they were burning for a new destination, and the crew had learned to take advantage when possible. They hadn't gone deep into the system once they recognized it was of no value, so the auto only had a short climb to the transition point. After a few hours of burn, they were back to free fall while the last-second calculations were made for the jump.
Skipper!
Morgan twisted in the straps he was once more locked into, looking over to the signal station.
What is it, Anson?
Hachion pulse. Coded, sir. It's one of ours, she answered.
To my station, Morgan ordered. Hold on transition.
Aye, Skipper. Holding on transition,
the helmsman answered automatically. Morgan got the signal on his station and ran it through the decoding software, frowning as he read through it.
Well, he said as he hummed in consideration, isn't that something?
What is it, Captain?
Lee asked, leaning over in his direction. Morgan flicked the message to her station, not bothering to answer. She'd get more out of reading it for herself. He instead looked up to see most of the command crew staring at him.
New transition coordinates, he ordered. And a new mission. Signal general quarters and start running preparation drills as soon as we arrive. Looks like we're scouting for more dangerous game from now on, people.
Across a small yet oddly significant swath of the galaxy, a series of lone ships received similar calls and responded in kind. The Rogues shut down their current operations, closing up shop wherever they were, and immediately began climbing out of whatever system they were in. Operation Prometheus was shutting down. The fires they'd stolen from the gods were blazing well now in human hands, and it was time for them to turn their focus on more mortal targets. AEV Autolycus. The rendezvous system was unnamed by both Terran and Primine sources. There was a reason for that, of course. It was a dead system, no planets to speak of beyond a hot Jupiter orbiting the primary star every 4 days. The gas giant was so close that the sun's gravity was sucking methane and hydrogen out of the atmosphere, lighting a ribbon of flame between the two that was stretched to breaking by the rapid orbit of the giant world. Nothing other than sterile rock existed in the entire system, making it of no interest to anyone beyond a few of the more esoteric stellar physicists on board, who were even then eagerly turning the scanners of the ship downwell in hopes of finding something that completely escaped Captain Passer's imagination. No doubt it would be important to someone sometime, so he let them have at it as long as there was no need for the scanners to be used more practically.
Transition signature. Hold on, Skipper.
The signal's ensign frowned.
Multiple inbound transitions.
On screen, Morgan was calm.
He had a better idea of what was going on than the ensign did.
Closest signals will be live in 30 seconds.
Morgan waited patiently for the light from the newly arrived ships to make its way to the auto scanners. When the first did show, the situation was as he expected.
That's the Jesse James, Skipper,
the ensign said a moment later.
And the Song Jiang just pulsed. They're all Rogues.
It's old home week, Morgan said. Prometheus just got a new job.
AEV Boudica. Captain Sandra Hyatt looked over the command deck of the Boudica as it and the Bellerophon emerged from the solar corona of the Rankiel primary. The pair of heroics had worked together under the command of the Odysseus since they had sailed out of dry docks. In all that time, they'd seen a fair few fights, and a lot of light years, and now the pair would be sailing without the third sister of the trio. Hyatt didn't really know what to make of the issues the Odysseus was having. The idea that a starship could be haunted in this day and age struck her as simply ludicrous. But something was obviously going on. She'd seen the state of the Odysseus and read the initial reports, and there was no way the ship still needed weeks or months of repairs. Whatever was going on, however, clearly both the Commodore and Admiral had signed off on the orders, and that was all she needed at the moment. For now, the Bell and the Bow had their marching orders.
Hyatt contented herself with looking over the state of her command deck and took comfort and pleasure in its smooth-running operations. Lieutenant Commander Samuels was in the pit, the sunken section that housed the helm controls, moving almost languidly as she guided the Boudicca through the coronal mass of the star and into open space. She made maneuvering the big ship look like child's play, despite the relative proximity of the Bellerophon and their rogue escorts. Like most of the pilots currently commanding the helm and navigation departments on Heroic-class ships, Samuels was a former member of the elite squadron known as the Archangels, something that had made Hyatt cringe more than a few times in their previous missions when the young woman opted to maneuver the massive ship like a twin-reactor air superior fighter in a dogfight. They'd come through every scrap more or less intact so far, which made up for a lot, she supposed.
"Signal from the bell, ma'am," Hyatt's first officer, Commander Cedric Simmons, told her as he approached from the left side. "Course updates. We're to immediately make for the heliopause, orders from the Admiral and Commodore to follow just prior to transition." Hyatt looked absently.
"Send the updates to Samuels."
The short, dark-haired man nodded as well, turning back to his task as she wondered just what it was all about. She could make a few educated guesses, of course. The last furball they'd had with the Imperials made it clear that this new war was heating up. The Empire clearly had no interest in a cold war. With the limited intelligence she had access to, which was nearly everything Earth knew as far as she was aware, Hyatt had little doubt that they were again on the wrong side of a power differential. Whatever tricks the Admiral and Commodore had pulled out against the Drossen were unlikely to be enough against a stellar empire the size of what they seemed to be looking at now. Normally, the move now would be to talk, even capitulate if that was what it took to buy time. Unfortunately, the Empire had no interest in talking, or apparently fighting a war of maneuver. Their idea of a reconnaissance probe was to barrel on headlong into enemy territory and just start destroying things until they could turn up something of value. The fact that it worked for them just made Hyatt grit her teeth all the more.
"That sheer lack of tactical acumen should never be rewarded," she thought fiercely.
Unfortunately, it seemed that the Empire was happy to spend lives until they achieved their goals, and that was a sound enough, though wholly callous tactic, if you had the lives to spend. Earth could never pull that sort of crap, she was well aware. Such a strategy would work well in the short term. That had been proven multiple times in history. But the current world governments were too open and exposed by the press to survive that kind of idiocy in the long term. Even a relative press blackout on the actions of Black Navy operations, largely imposed by a simple lack of ability to get reporters anywhere near fleet operations, wouldn't impede news from reaching the masses. In fact, the blackout might actually enhance the effect, since the press would likely start speculating as losses began to filter back through the upper echelons of military circles. Sooner or later, the numbers would leak, and public relations would degrade in short order. Running a war the way the Empire seemed to would be political suicide on Earth, which was likely for the best in her opinion, though there were times she could wish otherwise. In a drawn-out war, public fatigue would come into play and begin to reduce support that was desperately needed if the Earth wanted to mount and maintain a credible defense.
"We need more time."
Time, however, was one thing that it seemed they no longer had. AEV Bellerophon.
"All ships on course. Formation solid, sir."
Jason Roberts nodded curtly, handing off a digital pad to his assistant.
"Thank you, Commander Little. Proceed on course. Inform me when Renkeel Control issues our transit paths."
"Aye, Skipper,"
Ray Little said from the pit, where he was casually directing the ship while keeping an eye on the surrounding vessels. They had most of their usual line of battle, minus the Odysseus, along with a few Primine tugs that were peeling off now that they'd transited out of the stellar corona. With those in the clear, he was looking at empty black between the convoy and the heliopause.
"Smooth sailing," he said softly, not really speaking to anyone as he made a few micro-adjustments to the navigational vectors to adjust for slight variance in the position of the system's larger planets from their records.
Roberts turned away from the helm and walked back to his command station, tapping out a command without sitting down.
His orders were on the captain's display, and he couldn't help but glance them over again as he thought about what was to come. He was privy to the details of what the Imperial recon team had likely managed to get off the Primine ship, and could read between the lines easily enough. The Commodore and the Admiral clearly felt that something big and bad was coming down the line, and likely to hit them right in the teeth if they weren't ready. Well, that was fine. He was all in favor of being ready. The situation with the Odysseus, however, was preying on his mind. Unlike most of the squadron, Roberts had been allowed over to see just what the fuss was over. He was still trying to wrap his head around it. Everything they'd seen over the years had seemed insane in the moment, of course, so perhaps this was just one of those things that would inevitably become part of his daily lexicon. But for now, Roberts had real serious issues with getting his head around the revelations the Commodore had brought to him. Odysseus itself, or himself perhaps, was one thing. Having seen the entity with his own eyes, he could reluctantly accept what seemed to be reality there. That the ship had somehow become incarnated as a young boy with a fetish for antiquated armor and pink eyeshadow? Okay, frankly, if he were to admit it to himself, and only to himself, Roberts had to admit that the pink makeup bothered him more than the idea of the ship having an incarnate soul. He would not say that out loud, especially not to anyone outside the service, as it might be viewed, might, hell, as being prejudiced against certain groups of people. However, it wasn't that. It really wasn't. Or he hoped it wasn't, at least. Sometimes it was hard to tell what even your own thoughts were. The color simply insulted his sense of professionalism, particularly the glitter. He was a little scared what precedent Eric would set for the Navy going forward this time, of course, but he doubted that they were going to wind up with a whole fleet of sentient starships, so if nothing else, any impact would likely be limited to the Odysseus. What the hell is it with that man anyway? Roberts wondered. Apparently, if there was anything weird in the galaxy, Eric Weston would trip over it, fall into it, and then pick it up and take it home for adoption. Better him than me. The two big heroics and their 8 escort rogues began the long slog of a climb out of the gravity well of Rankiel Prime, accelerating steadily as their powerful reactors spun up to full strength and they began warping space for the open black. The formation was carefully observed by nearly every scanner in the system. Even allies were wont to keep an eye on any source of that much sheer destruction sailing through their territory. With no untoward happenings, however, nearly a day later the group of ships made the heliopause and the official safe distance from which they could transition out. With their orders set, the bell, the bow, and their escorts vanished in a flash of tachyons. Behind them, they left an uneasy peace, fragile and waiting for the hammer blow that seemed certain to come. Chapter 6 Imperial Space, World Crikey. Yesan Mish walked with a careful and practiced cadence, his capped boot heels echoing sharply off the bonded stone floor beneath him. He was approaching the Imperial seat of power in the sector, which was firmly in the front of his mind with every step he took. None of the direct Imperial family would be present, of course, but in his experience that meant it was even more important to watch his step. The extended cousins who were entrusted with duties in outer sectors were often quite touchy about the positions they held for reasons he was cognizant of, since he was one of those distant cousins himself, in some ways. Granted, his position was earned more by merit than theirs, but blood played true just the same, and Yesan was too aware that if he'd been born a little closer to the Imperial throne, he would likely be in command of the home fleet, and not an outer sector fleet. Being appointed to a perimeter sector should, in theory, have been a statement of trust in their position and the quality of their work. In practice, the move was often perceived as a sign of general lack of competence, getting the idiot cousin as far away from real power as possible and all that. He was one of the few who understood that wasn't the case as a general rule, since perimeter sectors had to run much more autonomously than the core worlds. He had worked his way up the fleet ranks the hard way,
putting down spots of violence all over the Empire at least as often in the core as the Rim Worlds. Rim lords and ladies, however, could get extremely touchy with people like himself coming into their fiefdom with an imperial note of authority and throwing their weight around. He paused in the entry arc, silently waiting to be announced as all eyes in the large vaulted room turned to see who was standing there. In his lord's finest, Yesan waited perhaps a few seconds longer than he should have before he rotated his head just slightly to pin the nearest acolyte with a glare to melt steel. The man paled and immediately stiffened to attention and hit the announcing chime. A few moments after the room fell entirely silent, the acolyte spoke up. He didn't use an amplifier for his voice. One wasn't needed. The room was designed to channel and amplify sound from specific places, such that everyone in the room could hear anything said from those points with perfect clarity.
"Announcing Her Imperial Majesty's representative, Lord Yesan Mish." The announcement was soft, steady, not yelled in any way, but everyone in the massive room heard it all the same.
Yesan stepped formally into the chambers of the local seat of government and bowed precisely 10 degrees forward from the hip as he looked to where the sector governor was watching him. Yesan was well aware that the governor wasn't going to like what he was about to do.
"You may approach, Lord Mish," the governor said, gesturing him forward with a tired sort of look. "You think you know what's coming, but I'm sorry to say... you have no idea," Yesan thought grimly as he walked up to the podium for presenters and appeals to the governor. He wasn't there to appeal.
Yesan handed off his imperial note and attached orders to a runner who passed them along to the governor.
"Very well, Lord Mish," the governor said, looking the two documents over. "These all appear to be in order. What actions are you here to inform us of?"
Yesan fixed his gaze on the governor, not looking around to any of the other faces turned in his direction.
"I believe, Governor, that you would prefer if this were made a private matter." "We do not have time for this," the governor growled. "Some of us have work to accomplish. Present your position or leave."
"You asked for it," Yesan thought, considering the man a fool. It would have lost him only a few moments to quietly ascertain what Yesan wanted, and the results of not doing so were wildly unpredictable, since he had no idea what was coming. Still, it wasn't Yesan's problem anymore. He'd made the appropriate gesture.
"Very well, Governor," Yesan said crisply. "I am here to inform you that I am deploying the sector fleet to a forward action."
The governor snapped his head back as though Yesan had somehow managed to reach out and slap him. Murmurs of shock rapidly built around him, but he ignored them as he kept his focus on the governor.
"I don't believe I heard that correctly," the governor said, leaning forward with a dark look on his face. "I am very much afraid you did, Governor. Events in Othar space have conspired to require my full attention and that of the fleet as well."
Exclamations of protest erupted all around him, but none of those voices mattered. Yesan didn't care what local officials thought. They were important only in their small local spheres. None of them had any hint of authority that could impinge on him. They were no threat. The governor, however, was another matter. In practice, his own authority was equal to that of the governor. Yesan was, in many respects, a governor himself, only a mobile one. His primary area of authority was over fleet jurisdiction, which, in theory, put him slightly above local governors. But since he rarely had the luxury of building long-term support in a given area, that was offset somewhat by the local governor's network of influence.
"That," the governor said softly, silencing the talk, as his location was one of the acoustic sweet spots that brought his voice to every ear in the room, "would seem to be at best precipitous, Lord Mish. At worst, I would say it is a panicked overreaction."
Yesan tensed, but forced himself not to react to the jab.
"I would say that it is moving to eliminate a potential problem with alacrity," he said instead, smiling thinly.
The Others have recently altered their tactics and capabilities in surprising ways, and this inclines me to end the situation immediately.
That's fine, Lord Mish, but the whole sector fleet? That seems somewhat extreme.
The more force that can be brought to bear on the issue, the quicker we can resolve it and move on to more important business, Yesun said calmly. The governor frowned, but said nothing.
But our worlds will be left without protection!
Yesun barely glanced aside to see who had shouted that, then refocused on the governor without acknowledging the loudmouth. The governor sighed.
While he spoke out of place, the Honorable Neri has a point, my lord.
Every world has its own guard fleet, Yesun said simply. If those are unable to temporarily secure your worlds, then I must question whether you have been properly investing as per your agreement with Her Majesty's family. The governor flushed, but surprisingly didn't look away from Yesun's gaze.
I assure you, my lord, he said tersely, my guard fleet is to the full requirements of the law and beyond.
Yesun inclined his head and opted not to question the governor about the fleets of other worlds. He rather knew what that answer would be, and while it might be satisfying to put the screws to some of the honorable gentlemen in the room with him, it would be counterproductive at the very least.
I have no doubts, governor.
The governor's lips twisted. He certainly recognized the position his administrator's mouth had put him in. However, it was too late to change what had been said. He sighed and finally tipped his head to Yesun.
We stand informed of the fleet deployment, he stated. I will forward your decision to the core worlds with the next dispatches.
Of course, governor. Yesun once more bowed the precise 10 degrees required by protocol.
I will take my leave, then, the sooner to return the fleet to your jurisdiction. As you say.
Yesun retreated from the room, victory under his cloak. But now the real job would begin. He had barely exited the hall when he grabbed his ship communicator and called his adjutant.
Farron, has the fleet finished preparations? He asked as he walked.
Very nearly, my lord. How long until we can deploy? Yesun demanded, increasing his pace. Within the day, if it is urgent, Farron said. Is it?
Not such that I want to increase chances of any losses, but yes, Yesun said. I would be clear of the Othar sector and onto my normal duties as quickly as possible.
I will ensure that the fleet understands that, my lord. I believe we will be able to deploy the fleet by tomorrow.
Excellent. See to it.
Yesun ordered, closing the connection before any response could be uttered. The time for talking was over. Thank the makers.
Nabark?
Misrem looked up from her work as the adjutant stood in the doorway.
Yes?
Orders from the fleet, lord, the adjutant told her. The fleet is to deploy within the day. The Nabark sighed, nodding tiredly.
Understood. Thank you.
Dispatch the news to my sub-commander's adjutant.
As you will, Nabark, the man said before vanishing back out the door.
Misrem stared at the open door for a time, thinking about what the orders meant. She'd been expecting them for some time, of course. Yesun had given her more than enough warning of his plans. Her squadron was well ready to deploy, and could be underway within the hour if that was what the orders stated. This would be their third encroachment into the anomaly's territory. And this time it would not be a follow-up investigation or a probe with intent.
They saw our tails twice.
Misrem wondered if that would make the enemy overconfident or not. She wasn't sure just what they knew of the Empire, whether they had any idea of the size of the Imperial fleet. It was possible they actually believed that her squadron was a significant section of the Imperial order of battle. That seemed unbelievable, however. Based on what her people had retrieved from the Othar ship, it seemed like her squadron would represent a very sizable portion of the enemy's order of battle, so it was not impossible that they might make such a mistake. She didn't know, couldn't imagine, really, what it would be like to see an Imperial sector fleet bearing down on you if you thought a single squadron was impressive. She smirked,
imagining looking into her enemy's eyes upon their fatal discovery. The Pier Cone was a fury of activity as the import of the orders sunk into everyone, but Ames simply sat confidently in the center of the hurricane and looked bored. Internally, he was anything but he refused to show that to the crew around him. The Fleet Lord's orders were expected, of course, but they still shook everyone to the core. This would be the first major fleet action in, well, a long time. He'd have to check the records, but it certainly hadn't happened in this sector in living memory, at the very least. Unfortunately, it won't be much of an action, assuming the intelligence is correct. That was the real assumption, of course. But even if it was significantly off, Ames couldn't imagine that the full sector fleet would experience any serious losses. The Fleet Lord wasn't doing this just to end a minor border conflict. No, the Lord was making a point. To whom, exactly, Ames had no clue. But someone had clearly attracted the Lord's attention, and he could only presume that someone was about to be full of regret. For Ames and his Pierre Cone, it just meant that this mission would be ending and they'd be on to another shortly enough. He had some sympathy for the Oathers, more than many of his fellows, but not enough to muster any true care for what was about to fall upon their heads. He did have some level of curiosity about the anomalous species and the changes they'd wrought.
So many things seemed to have spiraled out of control, all beginning with the first time we scanned that seemingly insignificant vessel. Ames would take some enjoyment in reading about their technology once the reports began making the rounds of the fleet commanders in a few years. With a little luck, his ship might recover some interesting pieces of the tech before the fighting was over, and give him a first-person look before some official from the core worlds of the Empire claimed it all for the Empress. New technology was rare in the Empire, as very few causes had been found to justify devoting many resources for research. No enemy had given the Empire a real fight in longer than he'd been alive, considerably longer, in fact. By and large, the powers that be had no perceived reason to waste time improving what there was no need to improve. Not until recently, that was. The heavy new armor that had been retrofitted to his ship and many of the other ships of the fleet showed that the Empire was not totally hidebound in its ways. There was something hopeful there, he supposed, though that might just be wishful thinking. The Imperial Sector fleet buzzed with action, from the least of its ships to the Fleet Lord's own itself, every vessel a flurry of activity as the final preparations for deployment were made. Stores had to be transshipped, first from the planet to the logistics vessels, and then in turn to each of the combat vessels. Fuel matter was dragged in from the outer belts of the system as well as positioned strategically for them to finish securing their cores on their way out of the system. Dozens of light cruisers moved to the vanguard as the heavy cruisers provided the core of the formation, being built around the Lord's own dreadnought at the center. Destroyers filled out the remaining slots. Working through the local planet's night, the fleet was assembled and ready to move by the time the Lord shuttle arrived and docked with the Lord's own dreadnought shortly after local sunrise. Lord's own dreadnought, Empress Lian. Lord Yesan Mish casually looked over the preparations with a practiced look of mild disinterest. He found that crews generally tended to get nervous if the Fleet Lord showed too much interest in their actions, so he did the best he could to allay those reactions, as they tended to cause mistakes. He was generally pleased with the progress that had been made. He moved on, turning his focus from the actions of his own crew to the reports coming in from the other vessels in the local squadrons of the Sector Fleet. So far, all was well. They would have to rendezvous with the remaining squadrons, reforming the fleet before they moved on into Primine territory, but that would be relatively simple. Dealing with fleet officers always was, especially compared to Imperial politicians, at least in his experience. He didn't have authority to execute Imperial politicians, for one thing, which always tended to keep people's heads pointed in the right direction. Yesan finally settled into his own station, surrounded by the reports from every ship in the fleet, though with only the squadron commander's ships presented prominently in his displays. He wiped them all away with a gesture
instead bringing up the reports from Captain Ames and Navark Misrem. Those detailed reports had brought the situation more fully to his attention. There was so much in the Oether sector that had caught his eye once the fleet elements stationed there started actually sending real reports back, too. Initially, during the Drossen part of the campaign, reports had been sparse and vague. Only after the entire operation descended into chaos and other fleet elements were assigned did anything resembling useful reports make it back to his station. Someone had been hiding a lot about that operation from the start.
One more problem to deal with after this is all over.
On the surface of the reports, of course, the anomalous species was utterly fascinating. Any group that could field a stealth vessel as clearly powerful as that ship had been was simply not to be underestimated, no matter what anyone else believed. That was in part why he was ending this game now, rather than give them any more time to prepare their forces for fighting Imperial incursions.
One world. Amazing.
Of course, the intelligence could be faulty, in which case they would be facing more of a fight than he anticipated. Even in that case, though, he should have more than sufficient force to end the conflict once and for all. Once the battle was won, he would clean up this mess he'd inherited, bottom to top. Someone had been inexcusably sloppy in setting the action against the Oathers into play. Once he made certain that there wouldn't be any undue consequences to the Empire, he would have to track the guilty party down and ensure that the culprit never had an opportunity to be so sloppy again. On Her Majesty's orders. Chapter 7 Forge Facility, Rankiel, AEV Odysseus. All systems on the Heroic-class starship were now into the green. In fact, many systems were performing well in excess of their original specifications. This was partly due to improvements that had been made since the big ship had been built, but also had to do with how rushed the construction had been initially. All of this was great news, but for Eric Weston, it was also a headache he didn't need. The Odysseus was fit for duty, physically. Mentally and socially was another story, and he had no idea how he was going to put any of that into his reports. In the short term, they were fudging a lot of the official paperwork, using the time to tweak systems in ways they'd wanted to for a while. That would only keep things running along for a little while, though, and he was running out of places to tweak.
I'm going to have to take her out, at least for a shakedown cruise.
Eric knew that, but he really didn't want to push either his crew or his ship at this point. The crew were still getting used to the presence of Odysseus, and the young entity was nothing if not curious and inquisitive. He had a bad habit of popping up over people's shoulders, asking questions that they didn't know the answer to, and then looking disappointed when they couldn't respond with anything resembling a true answer. He was driving many of the ship's experts, some of the smartest people in their fields, completely around the bend. The hell of it was that Eric understood why Odysseus was doing just that. The questions that the crew knew the answers to, well, so did Odysseus, by definition. So why would he ever bother asking questions someone could answer? Unfortunately, that led to frustrations even with the people who were inclined to be tolerant of the entity. For Odysseus, Eric supposed it had to be just as frustrating, if from a different angle. He knew the boy was aware that he wouldn't be getting an answer when he asked the question. The boy, entity. No, frankly, Eric had to think of him as a boy. Nothing else made sense in his head. The boy wasn't looking for answers, from what Eric could tell. He was looking for engagement on the question. Nudging people with queries was his way of shaping thinking in the direction he wanted it to go, and Eric did understand that. But Odysseus needed to figure out a less intrusive way of handling his business, or he would drive people away. Already, Eric had received multiple transfer requests that, under normal circumstances, he would have approved immediately. As things stood, however, there was nowhere to transfer staff to, so whether people were happy or not was going to have to be a secondary concern for a while. The Odysseus needed to be active. Eric blew out a long breath. He got up from his desk, straightening his uniform.
We have a little while before the Enterprise arrives. It's time for a shakedown tour.
Odysseus watched, or perhaps experienced was a better word, every person on board the ship as they went about their work.
Dreams from the sleepers on board were his idle moments of drifting thoughts, while hundreds of things went through his mind at any given moment. Some of his feelings were normal, or they would be, for a human at least. He knew that much. However, he experienced things in ways no human ever could. But despite all those experiences beyond the human possibilities, he received no answers whenever he might ask the all-important questions.